Hello from Delinea, and welcome to the show. If you've been enjoying the 401 Access Denied podcast, then make sure to like, follow, and subscribe so that you don't miss any future episodes. We'd love to hear from you. Join the discussion by leaving us a comment or a review on your platform of choice, or by emailing us at podcast@delinea.com. From all of us at Delinea, thank you and enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the 401 Access Denied podcast. I'm Joe Carson, the host of the show, and it's a pleasure to have you back on and listening to some of our thought leadership sessions. And I'm really joined with an awesome guest today, somebody who I've known for quite a long time and have watched some of his webinars and sessions in the past. And it's such a pleasure to have you on. So, Brent, welcome to the podcast and show. If you can give the audience a little bit of background about who you are, what you do, and some fun things about yourself.
Sure. So my name is Brent Dieterding, and I'm a CISO, and I've been that way for like 2 years, but I'm a little bit unique because I spent 19 years on the vendor side, and I've carried a quota, junk like that, right? I talk to a lot of vendors. I love my job. I'm not burned out at all. Like, the stress is there. I mean, you report to a CEO, like, they're stressed. But that's not a burden, and my satisfaction is through the roof. So I love I love all this. I love podcasts. I love talking to people. Like, it's all fun and great. So good conversation in store today. I'm looking forward to it.
Fantastic. Give us a bit. What was your journey like to being a CISO? I mean, what were some of the things that you kind of, built you up? What were some of those important skills that you learned over the years that really helps you in your day job?
Yeah. So honestly, one of them is, I worked in an operations center, ran operations center for 15 years, right? And back then it wasn't ransomware, but it was like, oh my God, the firewall is down.
And everything. The DDoS attacks. And
but what you realize is that you're talking to people on a semi-regular basis who are having the worst day of their year or maybe their career, right? And we're doing it without video, all this. And so you come in and you're essentially the incident commander, right? Mm-hmm. It is the role that I found myself functioning in. And one of the big lessons that taught me that I was kind of forced to learn is to focus on things that I control. Don't focus on things and don't experience stress over things that I do not control. So as a CISO, like, the likelihood of some dude in China ruining my year is zero. Like, that's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. And that has nothing to do with what happens or doesn't. It's all to do, like, it's not going to ruin my year because I don't control that. Now, the things I do control, yeah, I worry about those just fine. But giving that focus, I think, makes me a way better CISO. And I learned that in on call with firewall issues in 2003, 4, 5. Stuff like that. So I think that was a very critical thing that I developed over a 20 plus year career.
No, absolutely. I think it's really important is that, when you've worked in very stressful situations in the past, you always find that, you learn to deal with it. You become very aware of how to apply that in other situations in the future. I always remember is, when I was doing different, positions in my past, one of the things was I remember going into an interview one time. And I was going into this position. It was working in a SOC, and it was all about managing foreign exchange money markets. And the person who was interviewing me said to me, he said, Joe, he's like, this is a very stressful environment. We're dealing with more money every day that goes through the stock exchange. There's millions and millions of dollar deals that goes through each system. Can you tell us, how would you deal with the stress in such an environment? And I was thinking, well, the job that I was coming from at the time, I was working in the ambulance service. And when my systems weren't working, people died. That stress is like, when you think about the impact of IT systems and technology has, is that you start really understanding about, when things don't work, there's bad things and consequences. You learn to kind of adjust. You learn to focus on the things that you can actually, you can manage, you can change. And I think that was always the thing, is when you work in those types of situations, it really prepares you for a lot of different situations in the future. And you start getting that really kind of understanding about, how to prioritize things much easier.
Absolutely. So long time ago, 2003 or 2004 or something like that, So both my parents worked in the medical field in some form or fashion, right? And back in 03 or 04, I went with a friend of mine who was a volunteer paramedic, right, down in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. And I went on a run with him in the ambulance, and like I love it. Like I called my wife and I was like, "Hey, let's be thankful that I found cybersecurity before I found emergency medicine, because I really like this a lot, and I have a knack for it. I'm really good for it." And it's specifically because of that kind of just attitude of calm. Like my mom had some health emergency kind of issues when I was a teenager, and it did, like I get calm and focused. So some of that is natural, I suppose, how I'm wired. Like I'm wired pretty well to be an instant commander, things like that. But I don't get flustered. My heart rate doesn't go up. I just get focused,
I
and
think
that's
that's really important.
partially. Oh, it's partially it's that I've developed that on purpose over time, and it's very useful as a CISO because it allows you to be happy.
So tell me a little bit about the CISO, role itself, and to what's some of the prior how do you prioritize your day, and are you really focusing on the day-to-day stuff, or do you have a strategy that's how far does your strategy go? I've heard some CISOs that might be, looking at an 18-month, runway. I've heard some that have a 5-year plan. What is, what kind of does your strategy look like?
Sure. So I think of things, I've got to give credit. The first time I heard of this was Andy Ellis, the former CISO of Akamai, Orca Security, all that. And he has the pyramid of pain, is what he called it, right? And it's simplifying the categorization of risk very, very quickly, right? Is this a tier 0 or 1? And really, it's how surprising would it be if it happened, and how bad would it be? So if it's repeating and happening like right now and it's devastatingly bad, that's a dumpster fire. You don't need to talk about it. You just go fix it, right? Same thing with things like, oh, well, this could happen tomorrow and it would be really bad. Like, none of our users have MFA. Guess what? That's a dumpster fire. Go fix it, right? And then we get into kind of tier two, which is like, okay, I'd be a little bit surprised if this happened, and it'd be kind of bad. And then you get like, oh man, I'd be super surprised if this happened, and even if it did, it wouldn't be that bad. So I kind of put it in those tiers, and then those are the tiers that I talk to, we're a privately held company, to my executive team about. And 0 and 1 is material risks, right? Those are like dramatically bad, right? Tier two is like, hey, we need to take care of it. And really where I am is tier three, right? Some things like, it's worth talking about. It's worth doing something about. It's not worth a lot of money. It's not worth a whole ton of time and attention, but that's kind of the quick way that I think about risk. And I find that that works very well for cyber and also non-cyber risks. Like I can look and say like, hey, guess what? The effect of exchange rates, we're a global company. The effect of exchange rates on our company could be a big deal. The effect of having TikTok on someone's personal mobile device is not nearly as big of a deal, right? I mean, maybe we want to talk about both, but like big deal, little deal kind of thing, in very, very basic terms, because the categorization doesn't matter nearly as much as what you're going to do about it. And I kind of go back to significant risk reduction is simple, easy, and cheap. And so I tend to focus a lot more on the protection side of things and on, we might call it protection, we might call it resilience, we might call it whatever you want to. I focus a lot more on that than I do on possible of what might happen, right? Because what I find is that if I focus on protection and resilience, then that addresses most anything that can happen, not every possible thing, but my overall design criteria is mitigate material risk aside from nation states and make nation states really have to work for
I
it.
mean, what
And
ultimately
that's
is, you want to make the attack scenarios as costly as possible for the attacker, because the
exactly.
more I will say that the more time and the more resources and the more money they spend in trying to attack you, They got to be then. They got to be, you know, a dedicated, you know, focused attack rather than the traditional opportunistic, which most attackers are. They're looking for that, basically, that low-hanging fruit. They want to do it quick. They want to do it fast. They want to do it as cheap as possible.
Yeah.
And the more you put on them...
luggage lock, right?
Yeah.
Like make it, now, for most of us, most of us are luggage lock. Like, make the other guy more attractive. Now, I would feel 100% differently if I was Boeing. Mm-hmm. Independent state secrets or military terror, hardcore intellectual property, right? I mean, so different environments require different focus, right? Which is pretty obvious, right? But at the end of the day, like, you know, I remember a story from way back in the operations center where messed up, right? Whatever happened, messed up, and firewall went down for a few minutes in the middle of the day. And I called the client, I called the guy, and I was like, hey man, we screwed this up and the firewall bounced. It shouldn't have been down for more than a minute, something like that, but it's good. And he's like, I don't care, man. Like, we make whatever they made. Yeah. So when the internet goes down, the owner likes it because productivity goes up. I was like, huh. Right?
Yeah.
Now, in the meantime, like, I've been, you know, I manage thousands of firewalls, hundreds of environments, and it's like, and they're like, no, we make money by making thing, so okay, this is 2005, so a little bit different.
Internet then was a luxury. It wasn't a digital business. It was probably more the traditional kind of, you know, physical kinetic.
Yeah, always have to kind of say, like, what moves the needle? What is the big deal for your company? And if, you know, you're manufacturing, it's probably availability, right? But intellectual property comes in there. And if you're banking, it's more integrity or confidence, like whatever the case is, like, where do you make money? And that's also the lens that I have to keep in mind whenever I'm talking to my exec team or when I'm talking to vendors or my team or whatever. It's like, okay, is this a big deal, little deal? And is it a big deal, little deal to what part of the company? Right? Yeah. To the company overall, like, oh, hey, you know, this thing, yeah, it's an issue, but it's 1% of the revenue. Okay. Does it also have carry-on domino effects, or would it be isolated?
Being isolated, you know, that it doesn't spread across the organization. That's one thing is I always enjoyed it. You know, I remember years ago when we all used to talk about software-defined networks and everything. And I went to the Estonian government one time. We're like, oh, you gotta implement software-defined networks. That's the way to go. It's all about the software. And they were going, you're way behind. And it was one of those realizations. They looked at it as from a service-defined network, and the services were the business lines or the services they were providing to citizens. And then each of those services then had applied a business risk and a financial impact. And for that, it was a realization is that, you know, to your point, is you got to look at is what are the impact of the business if that service is out? And what's the domino effect? And, you know, can it spread to other services? And for me, that was a realization. Absolutely. You have to have an understanding about, to your point, you know, the example is that the internet access, because it was a time people became more productive because it meant people were not wasting their time, you know, surfing the web. They were actually doing their job. So really finding that fundamental, the risk itself from a business perspective is critical, because then it allows you to make sure that you know, which are your focus, your SLAs and OLAs that you need to have in place.
Yep.
And what's your, I think, you know, I really like one of the things that the Gartner referred to as the protection level agreements. I like that definition because it really defines, okay, when we have the business risk, what's the protection you've agreed with the board to cover that?
Yeah. One thing, I find that my kind of quick and dirty risk categorization also works in my focus on resilience protection works well outside cyber as well. So when I go and kind of establish a framework a little bit about surprising and impact, right, to other areas of the business, then it encourages them to think in similar ways. Mm-hmm. That isn't like bogged down by lots of terms that we can
get acronyms and technical terms that they kind of they lose it.
just talk about vulnerability. Just the term vulnerability, or the term risk, or the term threat appetite, or risk capacity, risk tolerance, like all these terms, we can get into incredibly long pedantic debates about what they mean.
Mm-hmm.
And don't get me wrong, it is good to have a good firm understanding about what like vulnerability means. It's actually kind of complicated, right? It's just kind of an involved thing and requires a whole lot of stuff. But if I can quickly get my VP of finance to proactively think about and say, you know what? There's a, like Brent told me about what deepfake technology is. And I know that our resilient, our processes are fairly resilient, they're fairly robust, but there's this one thing, and I'm gonna think about that. Okay, and then when I talk to him next quarter, and I'm like, hey, have you thought about how any of your processes could be manipulated, right? And he's like, you know, I was thinking, we could talk. So what I'm doing is I'm teaching other areas of the business how to think in risk terms, right? Mm-hmm. And I'm doing it with a very simple, like their eyes don't glaze over with all these pedantic arguments about vulnerability and risk tolerance and risk capacity and all that. But I can teach them a little bit about a framework and they go, oh, well, this is, I'm like, big deal, little deal. Oh, well, this is kind of medium. Okay. Yeah. So what can we do about it? Because what we do about it is the biggest thing. Mm-hmm. And that's really my issue with a lot of, you know, third-party risk management things, mm-hmm. right? Like, I don't care about the scans or the SOC 2, Type 2. Mm-hmm. Or, what I care about is, are they janky? Is our data at risk? And if so, let me go talk to the business owner or the owner of that service, of that product, and be like, hey, from my perspective, this is a little janky. And I'm like, well, what do you mean by that? And then we'll get into the conversation. And if it's like, oh, well, okay, big deal. Again, big deal, little deal. Like, is this something that requires a larger discussion? And as a CISO, I can say, we need to talk about this more. Yeah. And or I can also be like, security, but I'm not worried about it.
Yeah, I remember doing, I took the cyber approach one, it was quite a few years ago. It was a pen test and working with the CISO in order to kind of get, an increase in their security budget and to be able to achieve all the things they wanted to do. And we went for the fear approach. And the CEO and CFO just it scared them, but they were very pragmatic and thinking about, well, they were looking at how they measure things differently. And ultimately it came down to that, you know, the CEO said, show me the tangible value. And that was right. The quantifiable, you know, value of what you're doing helps the business. And so the CFO kind of made a big realization. He always remember when he says, you know, the cost of doing something versus nothing. His simple math was that, you know, show me, I don't want to spend more to protect something that's got less value than what you're actually spending on.
Is this a $10 solution to my $5 problem?
Right.
Just because that organization, it's a $50 problem, doesn't mean, I don't care. To me, it's a $5 problem, and that's a $10 solution. I assume that every product on the market is an elegant solution to a real problem.
Yep.
My challenge is to quickly and easily say, is this a $10 solution to my $5 problem? And how I do that is, when I look at how I spend my time, or my team, how they spend their time, or a vendor, or every line item on my budget, it's the same basic question. There's several different ways to ask this, but this is a little bit more convoluted, but a little bit clear at the same time. And that is, tell me a plausible story about how not spending this time, spending this money, costs my company a lot of money, right? Because if I can't tell that story like that, I better think about it.
Yep.
Right?
Yeah.
Now, and frankly, there's a lot of things out there that I can't tell that story for my organization.
Mm-hmm.
Now, maybe I could for a different work. That's fine. But my job isn't to defend them. It's to defend this one, right?
Yeah.
So that one question, I emphasize this to vendors all the time. Like, do that. Because if you tell that story, if you tell a story that is plausible, specific to that organization where they're going to cost a lot of money, so you can the CISO will take that and they will sell it to the CEO and the CFO and anyone else.
Yeah.
When I sold, I worked for SecureWorks for 19 years, and I had a CISO ask me and say, hey, how do I'm sold. I like it. How do I sell to my CFO? I said, oh, that's easy. And which is not exactly what you want to tell CISO. Like, oh yeah, that's easy. But he let me get away with it. And I said, so here's how I would sell it. And I went through boom, boom, in just 30 seconds. And he's like, that's awesome. That just didn't work. I said, I think it will. I'm seeing it work. Beware though. If you do that for this, your CFO is going to say, that's cool. Do it for every single thing that you spend money on. And he's like, well, that's probably not a bad thing. I'm like, it's not a bad thing. Like, yes, we should, as a CISO, or as anyone, as any executive owning my budget, I should be able to defend any of my budget items with, yeah, this is a quick and easy story about why we're doing this. And sometimes the answer is, well, we must be compliant to operate as a business with whatever. And that compliance thing says thou shall, so I shall. Like, I don't have a choice in the matter. It's like paying taxes. Maybe whether you want to or not, it doesn't matter. Like, you're doing it, right? But then there are a lot of other things where it's like, well, I know that this reduces risk, and I can tell a story like that. So do that, right? And what you notice is, if you tie back to the pyramid of pain idea, is that those are the things that are knocking out material risk. Yep. And then it's like, well, should I spend $480,000 to do this thing that doesn't really matter? I can't that, like, I can tell a story, but it involves four levels of theoretical James Bond scenarios. Probably not.
Yep. Maybe, I think but some of the challenges that many CISOs and organizations have is sometimes also letting go of the past. So that's always the thing, is that, you know, if you're going to do something more, does that fundamentally allow you to get some of the old legacy stuff away? It's always a challenge. Where's that confidence level of, you know, once you've got to be able to take some of it away?
So here's the other thing, and this always fascinated me in sales, right? And still today, if I stop doing something. But it was me who made the decision to do that in the first place. Is that compromising me? Like, well, I thought this was a good idea 3 years ago, but now I don't think it's a good idea. Like, am I going to look bad? Yeah. Now, me, I have no problem saying, like, I made the wrong call, or technology changes, or the threat landscape changes, or whatever. But when you are selling something, right, and you want someone to replace something that they already have, you're asking them to emotionally go against their own position, right? And by the same token, like, on the sales side, it is never a good idea to call someone's baby ugly.
Right?
And our program is our baby, right? So if you say, like, oh, well, you shouldn't do this, it's like, leg roll, slow down. Like, I made that decision, right? And if that decision involved a lot of money, I have to then say, I made a wrong call. And that may be hard. Like, and a lot of people may not emotionally or politically or whatever be able to do that, right? I have no such qualms, but I think it's my observation being from the sales side is that it's extremely common that people actually get very defensive of their mess.
Yep.
Right? It's like a baby sitting in a really full diaper. They're like, ah. It's a diaper full of crap, but it's warm and it's mine. Like, people get very defensive.
They are very, very protective. Not just defensive, but they I remember years ago, I was in that awkward situation years ago. I was working for HP. And I was over infrastructure tools for all the data centers. Australia. And it was just, HP acquired Compaq. And they acquired all their data centers. And what was really awkward was, I was a HP employee, so I was HP, in a Compaq data center.
Yeah.
And my job was to map what Compaq was using in their data centers over to HP's technology. And that was such an awkward situation, because you're in that situation where you've got Unicenter architects, and you've got TNG and Tivoli, and they're all used to using these tools in the data center. And now you're telling them, over time, they're going away. And it was very awkward. It was always a difficult situation, but you're trying to show them that change is good, that it's a new skill. You're going to become much more enriched with knowledge. But it was you always had to approach it very, very, you know,
yes,
balanced and safe. That you're not taking something away, you're adding something to them.
M&A can 100% be like this, right? And another approach that I won't say I've seen this, but I'd be really, really tempted to do it. And that is to rip the Band-Aid off and just do it really harsh all at once. Be like, listen, this is the way it's going to be. Mm-hmm. We're doing this, 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 and this. Get your feelings hurt about it. We'll have a beer on Friday. And just rip the Band-Aid off, do it all at once. Because I found that those culture things can drag on for many, many years and can be a real anchor as well. And, it works out, but it takes a long time. And at some point, you kind of have to be like, should we just rip the Band-Aid off quick?
Deal with the pain quickly, then prolong. And, so.
Yes. And especially on things like what tools people use. It's like, but I mean, then you, all of this, though, whether it is a CISO, whether it's just a person in a critical role in an M&A, whether it is sales, whether it's just being a person, is empathy and understanding the people that respond to their incentives, right? So we have the ability to care about what this is. And honestly, giving a damn is really important. And if people know that you give a damn and you just call some things out, I find that works really well, because at the end of the day, a CISO, a report to the CEO, my job is like partial. Sometimes I got to make decisions that my team may or may not agree with for whatever reason.
Yep.
I have decisions that I may or may not agree with, and that doesn't matter, right? So at some point, you've got to empathize with people and be like, listen, I know that you did not agree with this, but this is the way it's going to be. Now it's time to get all on the same page. One team, one dream, let's get it done, right? And that applies to a lot of things. Just giving a damn makes a big difference. Caring what other people feel and think like makes a big difference as well.
Absolutely. One of the things I want to go back on something we kind of covered a little bit earlier, but we talked a little bit about things like, third party risk and supply chains and stuff. So what's your strategy? You know, what is that a major risk that you see, and what's your strategy to minimize or to mitigate, from a third party perspective? Because we've seen in the last year or two, a lot of the compromise, a lot of data breaches have been some type of API, data sharing, it's been third parties getting access to something. So how do you kind of, what's your strategy around that side?
So I get to go back and be like, so I talked to a lot of CISOs, and some of them, I heard a friend of mine said, yeah, we found out on Tuesday that we bought a company 3 years ago that none of us knew about. And I was like, oh, that sounds terrible. But when you're doing dozens or even hundreds of M&As a year, then that happens. I don't have to deal with that, right? So I have to protect my environment, right? Not someone else's environment. And this is not something that causes a significant amount of stress or time waste for us. I focus on having a lot of conversations, right? So I'll take a given vendor or a given third party, and I'll think about it, and I'll talk to my team about it. And then I'll also go and I'll talk to the owner of that process or that function or whatever, and I'll talk to them. And I'm like, okay, so, and I lead the discussion about like, what would happen if, right? And try to determine like, is this something that we need to really talk about with a broader group? Or is this something that it's like, okay. Like, so for example, if X vendor thing were to go away for an hour, would we notice? Okay, what about a day? What about a week? What about a week? And if the answer is like, oh, okay, well, at a week, we at a week, we get to kind of start talking about different, okay, well, what would we do? Oh, well, we would do this. Okay. That's probably sufficient for that. Mm-hmm. Whereas other things, it's like, all right, what if they went down for an hour? It's like, oh, good God. Like, that's a bad day. It's like, well, then we probably need to talk about that one more now, don't we? Mm-hmm. So there again, it is about prioritizing the risk, not only from a cyber perspective, but from a down availability perspective, data breach. Like, what of our data do they have? And if so, like, I don't want to be too callous about this, but who has how much liability? Mm-hmm. Well, okay, well, and also, if that happened, is anyone going to worry about our data? Mm-hmm. Like, so if Microsoft or Google or whomever were breaching every email that they had was accessible to China.
Mm-hmm.
What number on the list are we?
Yes,
that they care about. And I mean, it's not the end all be all, but it's a reasonable question to ask, right? Like, if I am Boeing or Bank of America, well, okay. If I'm critical infrastructure, okay. If I'm me, I mean, we're not number one, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so there again, like, quick and dirty categorization, because the important part is to drive the discussion to say, what the hell did we do about it?
Yep. And I think it gets into the kind of discussion whether you're a primary victim or a secondary passerby victim. And, you know, and that's that kind of scenario, is that if you're a primary victim, is that they're going to be really, you know, the data is going to be the first thing they're going to look after. If you're a secondary, they may never even get to it. It may be something that they just, you know, it's just collateral damage is part of, you know, the overall.
It also goes back to, what do I control, what do I not control?
Yeah.
If I don't control that thing, then, I mean, I'll call out, we can talk about it, but I can't do anything about it.
Yep.
Just like, I cannot do anything. We have significant operations in the Philippines, right? I can't do anything if a tsunami hits Manila. I don't control that, right? Now, there's a whole lot of stuff that we do control, and there's a whole lot of stuff that we do, and that's fine. But do I control it? Do I not control it? That's a big focus. Like,
What things have you done in order, you know, in those side of things? A lot of companies went through and they've done, you know, compliances in order to identify those risks and try to look at offsetting them. You know, whether it being in the financial side with PCI, just the, you know, ISO standards, and also organizations have also been down the path of cyber insurance, and also for the financial safety net. You know, what's your approach on those side? You know, whether for compliance or cyber insurance.
So I'll talk about cyber insurance a little bit. So, we renewed our cyber insurance after I had been here like 9 or 10 months, and our premiums went down by a third. The following year, they went down by another quarter. So over a 2-year time frame, I cut our premiums in half for slightly better coverage. Mm-hmm. And it's still big, well-known brands and all that.
Yeah.
And I did it because I know what moves the needle on risk.
Mm-hmm.
And I had this last one, I had 26 underwriters on the phone. And I sold my program in 2 slides and 10 minutes and got a reduction. Now, how much of this is me and my program or the whatever, right? Doesn't matter. But I never mentioned a framework.
Mm-hmm.
I mentioned the 5 things that we do to substantially knock down risk. And then I literally had a slide with a big table full of all the stuff. I'm like, yes, we have policies. Yes, we have backups. Yes, of course. And then I would like 3 or 4 clearly check the box. They're like, can you clarify? Mm-hmm. Yes, of course. Right? That kind of stuff. Like, do you encrypt data at rest? Yes, of course. Right? All this stuff. And that made a difference. And someone is going to regulate you, right?
Yep.
There's always a regulator. And it can come in the form of the law, it can come in the form of regulation, it can come in the form of compliance, it can come in the form of cyber insurance, it can come in the form of bad guys. Mm-hmm. And the cheapest and easiest way is to self-regulate. So I self-regulate. My approach is very much, I'm going to do the right things to knock down material risk to my company, And then we'll do the paperwork to figure out whatever else we gotta do. And that appeals to separate insurance. That appeals, like, that way my answer to anything, do we comply with? I'm like, almost assuredly, yes. We probably, we may not have done the paperwork for it, but yes. Like, we're doing all the right things that anyone would, anyone could expect or demand. And we can fill up here all day. That's not a problem. With some caveat. The caveat here is like, okay, well, if you want to start doing a significant amount of business in the EU with GDPR, we got to talk.
Yeah.
Because I don't deal with that, right? So now, could we? Yeah, I'm sure we could. But that's a big enough thing. Or federal government, FedGov, like, there'd be dragons there. Like, we got to talk about that. We got to think about it. But in general, I am very much a do the risk reduction things that are simple, easy, and cheap, and then figure out the paperwork from the back end.
Yep.
And I find that that works. And I find that that cyber insurance responded very well to that.
I think was it one of the things we did. I did a previous podcast talking about, you know, a risk and governance and compliance.
Mm-hmm.
And it's really interesting that the kind of recommendation from the auditor was to make compliance and risk as a part of your cybersecurity program. Many organizations do it the reverse. They have security basically doing the checkbox of the program itself from a compliance program. And it's the wrong way, because what you're doing is you're doing security for the sake of meeting the paperwork.
Yeah.
And to your point is absolutely, if you do security best practices right, it's typically going to be the foundation for multiple pieces of paperwork or compliance and checkboxes.
Now, but consider, so in my world, if we are not compliant, that is a material risk to the business.
Yep.
We don't get to operate. So there's a whole lot of stuff that, like, I have to do and I have to pay attention to and I've got to do because I've got to ensure the compliance. Like, lack of compliance is, which, funny thing, that also means that the compliance framework or whatever, that's the thing that is enabling the business.
Yep.
I'm really not, right? I'm just the... But to that point, if it's stuff that I have to do, I want to spend as little time and effort on it as possible. I want to spend time and effort on things that are move the needle to reduce risk, right? Which I have strong opinions about that apparently cyber insurance agrees with. So,
which I completely agree, because cyber insurance has really taken that a lot of the basically the frameworks and done a lot of copy paste in order to basically saying that these are the things the framework's looking for, so they must be the right things. But if you take it from a program, a security approach to what things are the most effective, you're typically going to automatically meet a lot of the checkboxes. But there's probably a few things that you have to do in a certain way, or you have to show evidence of auditability and the controls are in place. And that's the paperwork pieces. That's typically making sure that what you've already done is you're doing it in a process that checks the box off of the paperwork piece.
Right,
which I think is the more effective way, and it's more cost effective way as well.
It is easily the, like, self regulation and doing things to move the needle on risk are easily the cheapest, most efficient way to go about doing this.
Yeah.
So now, when I say simple, easy, cheap, right? People can get a little frazzled by that. Simple is a technology statement, right? Cheap is cheap.
Mm-hmm.
Easy is the people process part, right? And for that, you can get better at that. You can get more persuasive. You can get better language. You can get a better lens. You can get, like, all that is a trainable skill, right? And just me saying, oh, we should do this, doesn't mean that we're going to go do that. But if I can build a coalition around things like getting rid of on-prem AD, or not having anything legacy around, or no BYOD, or everyone no questions as a YubiKey, things like that. I can make that argument, not in one big grand, like, oh, here's my case, but in a million different conversations with a big coalition, and then we get a lot of people going, 100%, yeah, agree. Mm-hmm. Right? That's a good thing. Yeah. All right. And so I have not found a significant challenge in my experience getting things done that are fairly well self-evident, right? And things like strong MFA is pretty much self-evident. Yeah. I think, right? I can explain that because it's faster, easier, cheaper, dramatically more secure. And you don't have to be the best salesperson in the world to sell faster, easier, cheaper, and more secure.
Yeah.
Right. So, and I always attribute this back to, if you ask 100 people, are mm-hmm. you an above average or below average driver? 90-something% of them will say that they're an above average driver, which means that 40-something of them are not right.
Mm-hmm.
If you ask 100 CISOs, how can you get 99-point-something% of your users using strong intent? Not a lot of them. Like, no, not in my environment. I'm not saying you're wrong. There are environments where that would be extremely challenging, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
I live in Tallahassee, Estonia, and we're a country that the entire country uses MFA. So, but
I'm using that. It's true, and I'm going to use it.
It's the point where. But one of the things is I remember I listened to a talk last year from the former president, President Rivas, and he did a talk. He says the important part of making that successful was the preparation and planning and education beforehand.
Yes,
and that was what was critical. He said before they were able to get that stage, is they had to make sure that the citizens were aware of what was coming, how to deal with it, and add value to them as well. So yes. not only do they get it for, you know, doing the one thing that, you know, it protects them, that it actually enables for much more things. I remember even doing a training course. It was did a risk assessment for a large transportation company. The same thing is that they realized that if they're going to basically want to protect their employees, they actually started realizing that how do we add more value? How do we get, you know, and they realized that actually let's give free versions for all of their family members. Let's expand it to their home, because they realized that actually security doesn't start at the office. It doesn't start with the employee. It starts with the social sphere. And they realized that if I can not only protect the employee and actually expand that to giving licenses for their kids' devices, their, you know, siblings and their family and everything else, and you protect that home, what you're doing is you're protecting a target, or, you know, that, you know, landscape or attackers go after, and you're making it more difficult for them. And in many cases, you know, it's at a very low cost as well. So that was going to that point, is that, yes, I think that every company around the world, every employee, every person can get to MFA. But it's the journey to get them there beforehand is sometimes the most critical part.
Yes. So to put it this way, I have 100% of my users have a YubiKey.
Mm-hmm.
Yay, go me! Right.
That is one of the fundamentals, kind of one of the best protections. If you can get to the point where it really mitigates a lot of the attacks out there. To the ones that are very, you know, it's not 100% protection, but it's one of the most difficult for attackers to abuse. Yeah.
Right. And this includes, you know, call center agents in the Philippines. I mean, like, and my new example is like the entire country of Estonia has MFA. So, like, and you can't do it for your 1,000-person company. And like, come on now. And truly, I mean, some environments really, really are difficult. But, so 100% of my users have YubiKeys, right? And I even see it in like the employee surveys that we do. People are like, oh, YubiKey's awesome. It's great. I have people I'm walking through, people are like, I love my YubiKey. I don't even know my password anymore. I'm like, yeah, good.
And so, then your point as well is that you're not only putting MFA in place, but we're also moving passwords into the background. And that's one of the biggest pains, is that getting that balance is about you're giving them something that, you know, they might have to learn. There's a learning curve to be able to understand about how I can apply it. But at the same time, I'm taking away one of your biggest pains, which is having to choose remembering enter passwords in. It's a win-win.
It is. And if you not, it's cheaper, because if you do that, then you don't necessarily have to spend, like, a lot of your $25 problems became $15 problems, or became $5 problems, right? And so then you can look and be like, okay, we're not going to do this. We're going to go in eyes wide open, and I think we can do without this. Okay, fine, right?
Yep.
And even things that would be like dramatically necessary in a lot of environments, you're like, I don't know. So That's fantastic. But when you can, how I dealt with that, that lead up, that preparation, right, is I'm a big fan of storytelling, right? Mm-hmm. I'm a big fan of like, hey, bad guys don't log in. Bad guys don't break in, they log in.
Yes.
Right? Now, I can say that because I'm a cybersecurity mm-hmm. expert. I've been doing this for a long time. People believe me. I'm a credible mm-hmm. statement when I say that. And because of that, the only way that you can log on is to physically touch that key.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning that even if a bad guy had your username and password, they can't do that. That's logical. It makes sense. People understand that. I'm like, okay. I'm like, and this is the cost. I was like, oh, that's not bad.
No, exactly. You're completely minimizing it down to back to the it's the physical side. Mm-hmm. Is that they have to, you know, so, basically hold that person to hostage and get them to do what you want them to do. and that minimizes it significantly, you know, where the likeliness of that happening. Or, you know, to your point, I really like the term you use. Is it surprising? I like that much better than the likeliness scenario, because it is more relative.
And yeah, and like the reason I don't like the 0 to 20, 20, 40% likelihood or whatever is because that tends to make people think that it's not just a wild ass guess. Whereas just using the emotional term surprising, like it's not great, but like it works because again, yeah. I want this to take 15 seconds, mm-hmm. right? Like we'll talk about it. That's fine. But like, let's have this take like no time at all and focus on what the hell are we going to do about it? Because then you can go, oh, well, like, don't care, don't care, don't care, don't care. Like it enables you like a scroll feed of, you know, like all of this, right? Mm-hmm. I have 80 to 100 things a day that I look at, I'm like, don't care, don't care, don't care, don't care, don't care. And I get to do that because of some of these other things that I did. But it all goes back to, like, you get to lay the groundwork, tell a story, talk to the people, because at the end of the day, as much as people might not like it, massive amounts of decisions in life are emotional decisions, right? And the currency of cybersecurity is trust and confidence. Right. Yep. When I talk to underwriters for cyber insurance, when I talk to my fellow exec team, right? When I talk to my team, when I talk to whatever, right? Trust and confidence has to come through mm-hmm. because no one is convinced based on head knowledge. Oh, here's our SOC 2 Tech 2. We're secure. Oh, here's our PCI DIB. Doesn't do it, right? What does it is like, that makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
That makes sense to me. And I see internal and external validation that what Brent says, what the CISO says, is accurate. I get external validation, but hey, we faced a named threat group. We faced scatter mm-hmm. spider throughout all of 22. Competitors are getting chewed up.
Yeah.
We're not. Okay. Hey, our cyber insurance went down by 50%. Okay. Hey, the CIO, who's been here 24 years, he says good things. So, like, everyone mm-hmm. is saying good things. That helps. It, as the CISO, it helps because then I get credibility, right? And I get credibility to protect our business, right? Like my job is not to, this is a slight thing I heard. I love it though. Is my job to secure the company or to protect the business? My job is to protect the business, right?
Absolutely. And that is, I always remember it's all about, it's about, you know, understanding risk. That's our job. We're risk professionals. And ultimately to protect the business and the revenue and also become enablers in how they can actually look at, you know, when they decide to take on new digital services is how quick can they do that in a safe way.
And to do enough.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's the fundamental question. Like security is a feeling, right? You can be in grave danger and feel just fine, feel safe. And you can feel incredibly unsafe and be mm-hmm. just fine, right? So that feeling matters. And that feeling matters. It's a little bit different for everyone, right? As to what instills confidence, what instills trust in them, right? So which is why like I care a lot about protection, but I also have to care about the feeling of trust and confidence mm-hmm. and in me as CISO, in my team, in our company, and all that. And for me, like we're a privately held company. So that means the owner. But how the owner feels makes a big difference, because guess what? He's my boss, right? Protection also matters, and protection informs my confidence. It doesn't necessarily translate to anyone who hasn't been doing cybersecurity for 20 years, right? So, like, I'm comfortable for a whole lot of different reasons, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you can tell me 100% YubiKey is, and I'm like, oh, okay, I'll be all right. But give me any environment that has 100% YubiKey is, and I'll be okay. It'll be okay. I have something I can work with now, I'm pretty sure, right? Yep. But when I say 100% YubiKeys to underwriters, they know. When I said to other CISOs, they're like, damn, that's awesome, right? When I say to a CFO, he's like, and?
What have you actually, from a business financial side, what have you done?
That's not... Right. And so, and that, at the end of the day, we're talking about education, which is head knowledge, but we're also talking about emotion, trust, confidence, credibility, all of these things, right? And some of that only happens over time. Like, I don't care who you are. If you encounter someone brand new in your life and they tell you X and you believe Y,
it has to be earned.
You're overcoming cognitive dissonance. Yeah.
You have to earn it, or you have to find mutual areas where actually that can be shared. And so this, trust is either earned or it's shared. And that's kind of.
This is all sales, right? We can call it borrowing credibility, right? Like, I can tell you, as a brand new CISO coming into an organization, like, you need, with very rare exceptions, if you're some sort of crazy, highly recommended or something, in most cases, you really need head nods from other people.
Yep.
Right? You need to borrow credibility from other people. If other people kind of head nod and go, yeah, what he's saying makes sense.
It's credibility. It's credibility. So, well, question: what's some of the what's the resources around you that helps you? You know, education or knowledge, or is there conferences you go to or books that you read? Well, what's the thing that you do in order to keep making sure? Because it's an industry of always change, and we need to always stay up. So what's the resources you use to keep you up to date?
So head knowledge is generally not a problem, right? I don't have a hard time encountering the knowledge that I need to know. What I do focus a lot on is I focus a lot on, frankly, sales, sales-like things, like persuasion, not manipulation, but persuasion, what makes a compelling argument, understanding different types of people. Like, I have thousands of data points on fundamentally technical people. Right, I've been interacting with CIOs, CISOs, security, cybersecurity, IT people for 25 years. Right, I got that. I run arguments by my wife, who's incredibly intelligent, but not at all a cybersecurity person, and be like, "If I say this, does that make sense?" She says, "Yeah, why are you talking down to me?" I'm like, "I'm not," but like that helps me, right? Like. Or if I can take any given concept, like, again, that cognitive dissonance thing is a big deal, right? So if you believe X and I tell you Y, depending on who you are as a person, that's going to take between 5 minutes and 5 months to overcome. But we got to start that timer, right? So, and it could be on religion, politics, whatever. I mean, take your nastiest issue that people get really emotionally fired about and do that and figure out how to talk to people. How to get them to engage?
How to find the balance that allows it to be a discussion and not an argument?
yeah, exactly. Like, it doesn't help we're yelling at one another, right? We don't have to agree, but if we understand the issue, because guess what? I don't necessarily care to get my way. And that's part of who I am as a person. I don't need to get my way. What I do need as a person is to be heard and respected. So if I'm heard and respected because the CIO has a different perspective, the CEO, the CFO, et cetera, and frankly, they may have a perspective with knowledge that I don't have, nor should I necessarily have. So they may, but so my goal is to make sure that we make informed decisions. And I know that when do I need to pound the table and make a big stinking deal about something, and when it's like, okay, right? big deal, little deal. So I tend to read a lot about emotional intelligence, mm-hmm. persuasion, sales, mindset, different types of
the psychology side of the.
Oh, yeah.
I guess that's the. It's really understanding about how people make decisions. You know, it kind of comes down to it, which I think is quite impressive. I remember reading the ABCs of cybersecurity, which was a great book. It was all about, you know, moving from taking small steps to getting it into your behavior, and then ultimately make it cybersecurity part of the organization culture. And I think that's that approach, because it really means what you're doing is you're making people think about it as habits, as a day-to-day thing, rather than just something that they have to do, because, you know, it's part of a policy, is that it becomes much more native to them.
If you understand who people are, like what their worldview is, then that can really inform a lot of like a cybersecurity roadmap, for example.
Yep.
Like, so if I understand that my privately held company, if I understand how conservative they are with risk or aggressive or whatever, then that helps inform me about who I'm working with. And really, because at the end of the day, like for a privately held company, you know how you define material? Is whatever the owner cares about, right? I mean, that's it, right? Like, because, and some of those things can get into somewhat sensitive topics. Like, if I say, okay, are you willing to lose $5? Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely. Kind of need to know how much is in the wallet. Are you willing to lose $5 and you get $10 in the wallet? That's pretty aggressive. If you have $5,000 in the wallet and you're like, $5 was okay, $10, nah, too much. Whoa, you're super conservative, right? Mm-hmm. So that informs kind of that. I mean, they get to make that call. They own the company, right? It gets a little bit more interesting about what does a reasonable investor think when we're talking about SEC. But even that, I think that we can work around that, right? But understanding that is not just a financial number, but it is worldview, how people approach the world, how they think about the world. And you get all those indications from talking to them about whatever. Like, I learned a lot about people talking about how their kids, traffic, weather, roads, whatever, normal chit chat tells you a lot. So part of what I do is I have a ton of one-on-ones with people around my company, right? Just to keep the pulse.
Find the pulse. It's like getting that temperature of the people and understanding about how important it is and what things you can do. Brent, it's been amazing and awesome having you on the show. You've been completely so valuable. Lots of great insights, lots of great approaches and strategies. For me, I learn a lot. That's one of the things I enjoy about these conversations is sharing experiences, sharing ideas and strategies, and then really kind of, you know, bringing it to the next level. And I think that's really, you know, the more we get our ideas and thoughts out into the industry and more people to hear them, ultimately, my hope is that, you know, through these podcasts and having you on as a guest, is that we're making the world a safer place, not just for organizations and business, but ultimately for everyone. Any final thoughts of words of wisdom you would like to leave the audience?
No, not specifically. Great talk. It was enjoyable talking to you. One of my takeaways is the country of Estonia has finally been dead. So
I'm going to for everyone. It's to the point where it's around 1.3 plus million people. It's a citizen ID that everyone, you know, from birth gets it. And it comes with basically two, you know, PKI. You've got an authentication PIN and an authorization PIN. So the authentication is for view and the authorization allows you to make changes and they use it for voting, for tax returns, for banking, to
everything.
Vending machines, to parking and loyalty cards.
Is it a physical card?
We have multiple. You have the physical card, which changes every 5 years. Most of them use it for, you know, passport. It's actually more secure and more valuable than passports. And then that enables you to then sign, you know, child certificates, for example, on your SIM card in your phone. And then you can use your phone as a primary method, and then the card is like kind of the master. But it's a great way. It's from a society perspective, it makes life and interaction with the government and even companies that use it as well much more seamless and enjoyable, to be honest.
Yeah.
So.
That is awesome to know.
That's cool. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, hey, thank you very much for having me on. I really, really enjoyed the talk.
Absolutely. So for everyone, you know, Brent, many thanks for joining me. For everyone, this is the 401 Access Tonight podcast, really bringing you ideas, strategies, you know, thoughts, and really, you know, to for you to bring back to your businesses and apply them. And hopefully it'll enhance your career and also at the same time, help you put things in place to help your organizations. Tune in every 2 weeks and look forward to speaking with you and seeing you in future talks. All the best and take care, everyone.
This podcast is brought to you by Delinea, the number one privileged access management solution for enterprises with complex hybrid IT environments. You can get our free ebook, Privileged Access Management for Dummies, by visiting us at delinea.com/PAM for Dummies. That's delinea.com/PAM4Dummies. From all of us at Delinea, thanks for listening.